You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right. Now, without further ado, right after that segment played, you can imagine how excited I was. And then Mr. Potato Head joined me right after that. So here he is, recorded that day. But I have to say, there's a reason Mike Musselman crosses paths with all these different guys in life, and that's because of the kind of leader Mike is. All the bullshit aside, there's people that care and there's people that devote themselves and go out of their way for people. And my friends are those guys. And that's why we're friends. We see the planet the same way. And we see our moral obligation as much more than what we do in our official capacity at work. That because of the courage and selflessness we've seen, because of the Marines we've gotten to know in our lives, they go an extra mile, and it's the best, and it's why you never get over being part of the organization. So on that date, as much as I hate to say good things about him, Gunner, he's good shit. Anyway, so here he is.
Ten minutes after 11 on a Wednesday. That's Michelle Branch right there. Slowing it down for all you couples out there. Joining me on his way to, he's driving someplace, is the guy who set up that whole interview with Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, and that is Mike Musselman. Mike, how you doing?
Hey, good, Mac. How are you?
I'm good. First of all, you're on the move today, yes?
Yeah, I'm in Oklahoma and up Minnesota. I should say Minnesota, as they say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You got to speak the language. Mike is from Minnesota, no matter how much shit he talks about Texas. So you're headed back to the motherland, and tell us about when you first crossed paths with Staff Sergeant Workman.
When I joined 3-5. I was by de facto the regimental gunner for 5th Marine, and okay. I was supposed to be the gunner for 3-5, but they deployed before I checked in, and so I met them over there, and we switched right after.
Okay, so this is interesting because Mike and I are battle buddies times 3, so I'm with 5th Marines, the headquarters element. Working at Camp Fallujah, and Mike joins 3-5, and then we had met in Ramadi in 2004, and
right.
Enjoyed Mike's company because he's disrespectful and he's a smartass, and so he and I have the natural kinship.
Attraction. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
We see the world the same, and the other thing is we have a very low threshold for stupid.
Right.
Oh no, that's stupid. And in a group setting, too, so that's another thing.
Yeah.
So,
remember, I didn't care who the audience was. It's something stupid. I made sure that got pointed out.
Exactly. So you're in 2006. They go back to Ramadi, and then Workman goes someplace else, right? Is he he goes to the drill
camp. We got back with Malay, it was a quick changeover. Pat Looney took over command of 3-5. We changed out some of the guys, and we had a real short workup. 6 months later, I was on the advance party back, and we ended up at Camp Mercury, was where we went initially, and then from Mercury went to South Camp Fallujah, and then South Camp Fallujah we ended up pushing up and ripping with the 110th Armed Pennsylvania National Guard guys up in Habania.
Habania, wow. The
yep.
Yeah, names from the past. You cross paths with him, and What's your first experience in terms of interacting with him? Did you know that he was struggling, or did he seem like just another Marine?
Mac, you got to understand. I mean, that after that deployment, there were a lot of guys struggling. You know, it could be said that Hutch, you know, the squad leader for the whole Hamdia incident where the guy was killed and they were brought up on war crimes, and you know, that the way that were enough. There was still a lot of guys suffering from the things that we made them do, or the things that they were exposed to. You know, and there was, as Jeremiah said in his interview, there was nothing really set up at that time. If you were diagnosed with PTSD, which at the time was kind of a catch-all, they just pumped you full of drugs, and then, you know, off you went. And you're done. Okay, next guy, sedate this guy, and then, you know, make him not a danger to himself or society, kind of the mantra back then. So.
So in that's the environment that you that so Workman's not alone in that boat, all right?
No,
there's a lot of guys. Okay.
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of guys. Workman's story ends with a happy note,
right.
You know, and that's a tribute and a testament to one, his character, and you know, he's a fighter, and not only in the realms of combat, but he's a fighter in fighting those demons and fighting those. Just that perception that when he got back and going through that, because that in itself is another combat zone. It's tough, you know, it's war.
So you first meet him, Mike, and what's the context in which you first meet him?
So I knew him. I knew him when he was still in 3-5, and then when he was getting ready to go, and then when he took off and went out to Paris Island, you know. There was a lot of talk about him, about, you know, that was probably not the right duty station for him to go. And like I told you before, there was a group of us that kind of argued the fact that he needs more time to decompress. A lot of those guys did.
Right.
Don't send these guys off on orders right away. And let's make sure that, you know, they're good. They got everything in order. Their mind is they're straight on this, and not to put them in a high intensity, you know, job like, you know, recruiting or drill instructor, somewhere they, you know, with, again, without the help, they're automatically just gonna, they're gonna go to the high side of that. So, but he was one of those guys, and again, he wasn't alone. But then I ran into Jeremiah I had orders, and I went to Webster Training Battalion under, the Don Constantini out there at Webster Training Battalion. And Jeremiah was out there working at the museum where I ran into him again. And he was working on a book not shortly after that. And we had some talks, and we talked about some different things. But, you know, again, you could see that he was going through a lot. And, you know, just like everything else, I after listening to the interview, I didn't know at that point that he was hurting that bad. But, you know, again, Marines are really good at hiding their feelings.
So he goes down to the drill field, and I don't want to say you're a prophet, but I mean, and you really didn't have to be one. You take those kind of guys that are struggling with those issues, that have that kind of anger inside of them, and you put them in that intense environment, you know, and then you're asking them to control their anger when, you know, they're, you know, a lack of sleep, long hours, and recruits doing stuff, stupid stuff, and you're supposed to stress them out. You know, and
right.
Then yet not cross a line with them, and you can see that, you know, sure as shit that that's going to be a struggle.
Oh, yeah. You know, and luckily there were some good people down there that took care of them. You know, but it was, and I would say, you know, you take care of someone, the point of it is to take care of them before a situation happens. Identify those things and move through those things. You know, again, it was that we didn't know. We didn't realize this. I mean, this was 2004. I mean, you're talking about a year and a half. It's been about a year and a half now since we've been in combat when we did the march up in 2003. So a lot of this stuff was just starting to surface, and we were just learning about it on the run.
Right.
And commanders were caught on, you know, off guard by this. So they didn't know what PTSD the effects would be and what this would happen there. They just kind of moved on from there.
Well, you know, I mean, let's talk about that, Mike, because, you know, there was discussions, you know, I remember before going home in 2004, you know, you had to go to a class and they said, you know, you're going to have some anger and you might have sexual problems, intimacy problems, you know,
yeah, but,
and don't get, you know, don't get mad at your wife if she spent all the money. And, you know, she had it rough too, which always started an interesting conversation. And so that was the extent of, but as you say,
right.
We didn't know, I mean, we didn't know what, obviously what we know now. But, I mean, yeah, we had a class on it, but our knowledge of it was nothing.
Yeah, but those classes were nothing more than every deployment you do. But even, you know, the 20s, I remember back in, you know, the early 90s, in the 80s, there was the same classes. You've been gone, take it easy, you know, don't try and beg your wife the first night, you know, just ease back into the relationships you've been in without. Those were the same thing. That's not what we were talking about. This was, how do you sleep at night, how do you go to bed at night with the understanding of the loss that you're feeling guilty for the loss of your comrades, or could you have done something different, or, you know, the seeing the full-on escalation of trauma to another human being, you know, those are those things that we did not know. We couldn't talk to anybody about. Hell, we didn't even have, you know, the right psychologist and therapists on the staff even address those issues.
Mike Musselman, our guest, the gunner, is the one who asked me if I knew Jeremiah Workman and would I like to have him on the program. I said, absolutely. I'd love to have him. I don't know him. Would love to have him. I know of him. And so, Mike, I will tell you, and I've done talk radio for 10 years. And that's the best interview I've ever done because of him and just his willingness to tell his story, how raw it was. And I when we were doing it last night, I was just sitting there listening to it going, wow, unbelievable story. And it's almost, you know, at first when you hear him say that, you know, he came back, you know, and he felt like a failure. And then, you know, and then he gets relieved, and then he gets the Navy Cross, and now he's a celebrity for failing in Iraq in that gunfight that he said he could have done more.
Right.
And then he gets relieved as a drill instructor. You know, and you hear him say, I'm a total failure, and now I'm a celebrity for it.
Right. The confusion.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't imagine having that, carrying around that guilt. And, you know, like I said, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I had, you know, I still carry guilt. There's, you know, things that you kind of look back and say, you know, why were we there? Why were we doing those type of things in that area? If we hadn't been, we wouldn't have lost these guys. And, you know, so you go back and you know, hindsight's always 20/20. You go back and get yourself. And you just kind of move on with it the best you can. And, you know, like I said a long time ago, you know, when I talked to a therapist on PTSD, she asked me, you know, the same kind of questions, you know, how is this going on? And I told her, I said, if it hadn't been for my wife and my daughter, I would have shot myself a long time ago. Because, it was difficult to come back with that on your mind of, did I fail? Did I do something wrong? Did these guys die because I made the wrong choice? Or did I do something just wrong? And, you know, you keep going back and forth, or could I have done something different to bring them back? You know, it's very, very difficult.
Mike, did you hear the story? And I forgot to ask him during the interview, but that he had relayed to me prior to the interview about going to the VA and having a female Iranian woman therapist look at him and say, it's because you're fighting an unjust war.
Yeah. That was her answer to his guilt. That's why she thought that he was guilty. And he came to the realization in his mind or subconscious mind that he was fighting on just war. You know, it's like, what kind of nonsense is that?
Rudy was just on and says that woman's lucky that he didn't stand up and snap her neck. You agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think I told you, you know, not too long ago when I walked into the VA in Dallas and a gentleman was sitting there. And not looking at any of my records or not even an x-ray or an MRI or a CAT scan, and he didn't sit up, he didn't introduce himself, didn't even offer his hand. He spun around the chair as I waited patiently for an hour and a half to see him, and within 5 seconds of me being in the office, he turns around and says, "I don't see anything wrong with you." And it took every ounce of professionalism in my body not just lay him out on the floor. It was just me and him in there, and by the time he woke up, I would have been gone anyway. But the anger that I felt in that room of just, you've got to be kidding me. You know, this is how, and if I'm being treated like that, you can imagine what these young guys with, you know, not 4 or 5 years in there, coming in there, not knowing what they actually rate or what they, what's required of those guys to do that. And those are isolated cases. You know, I've been, there's other cases where I've been at great service to these guys, but you gotta work with these gentlemen and, or ladies. Just, man, we're failing at taking care of our people.
You know, and again, it's interesting. And as you know, when I first talked to my, this is probably a couple months ago, right after that had happened. You know, we were talking about this, and just like today, I could feel your anger coming through the phone.
Yeah.
Because you were seething at this guy. Didn't, you know, Mac, he didn't look at it. He didn't examine me. He didn't look at an x-ray. You know, all he was trying to do was lower my VA rating and save the VA money.
Yeah.
Like, what the F is going on? And then workmen. It's because you're fighting an unjust war. What?
Right.
And this is my therapist is telling me. And so, you know, it's like, make it stop, please. Somebody help me. But the theme is, I interviewed that kid from 15 Nagel, right? He goes to the VA. He says, I had to tell my story to 4 different people, and I stopped going because I saw a different person every time. And then yesterday, Staff Sergeant Charlie Lindo said that he got horrible treatment at the big VA, so he went to a vet center and found somebody there. And then you know, and then this story, and to me, the message, and I want you to comment on this. We live, non-commissioned officers and leaders in the Marine Corps live with the saying, improvise, adapt, and overcome. And I think it would behoove us to tell Marines, with your treatment, when you get out, you're going to have to do that. Because VA is not going to come and serve you. You're going to have to find the right place to plug in. And you said now you plugged at the, what, County Veterans Outreach? Something like that?
Yeah, so the... it's the Veteran Service Officer. They have them here in one of the signs in each county. And they're their advocate, and they're good. And, you know, Mac, I have always related to working with the VA is like being in court. You have to prove your innocence. The burden is on you. You're the one that has to go out and find all the information. They are not going to bend over backwards to do something to help you cut a corner. To make sure the pain goes away, you know, and like I told the doctor, I care less what the rating comes out to. I just want the dream I have to, I would love to go to sleep like a normal person in my bed at a normal hour, not to the point where I have to stay up to the point where I'm fatigued at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning where I pass out because I can't sleep in a bed because my body, you know, and I'm tired of taking pills to assist me to go to sleep. That was his answer. Well, you know, you tried a sleeping aid. Are you kidding me? The rest of my life, I'm going to take sleeping aid. So, yeah, I just, it's aggravating. And, you know, to hear Jeremiah's story, it's just even more, it infuriates that we treated these guys like that.
But again, I think that it's a couple things. What the Vietnam guys did was they started those vet centers, and they were manned by veterans, hence the name vet center. They weren't manned by civilian people, and now they've been taken. Now the vet staffs them, or they're staffed with, I believe, their staff. They're not staffed with veterans anymore. There's civilians in there. And what the Vietnam guys wanted was an outreach center that when you walked in, you were talking to somebody who had your experience, or something similar. Hey man, what's up? Hey, you okay?
Yeah.
And you were back with your tribe, and so I don't know, I'm going to investigate that because that's what we need. And that's what the VA needs to get back to is, and that's what we're doing here, peer-to-peer stuff.
Right.
Peer-to-peer stuff. And that's what all this Facebook stuff, and that's what all these networks, you know, battalions are putting together to make sure they account for everybody on the net. And when somebody goes off the net, they get on the phone and they say, hey, who do we know that's near Sacramento, California? Hey, McNamara is. Well, he lives 20 miles away. Hey, will you go to this address and find this dude because he's not on the net anymore? We're doing that as an improvisation, right? Because we don't have what we're not getting what we need from the VA, and so I don't think that's a bad thing that we're plugged into each other, and thank God for the internet that we could do it, and cell phones and stuff like that. But I think we need to have it as a mindset. You're going to have to improvise and adapt and overcome in your care. There's not one solution out there for you. You're going to have to find the right person to help you get through it. And don't get frustrated. What Workman said, hang with it, work it, and do not quit. Don't quit.
You know, back to what you were talking about. So what they've done, Mac, and you know, in my case, one of the things that was extremely frustrating to me was one of the benefit counselors, people that are on your side within the VA that try and take all the stuff that, and then they try and push, work through it with the VA. So, granted, yeah, she was in the military. So what they do is, they're all military people. So the one that I was working with, here's the commonality, okay? My veterans care person at VA, she was in the Air Force, did 20 years in the Air Force, never left the United States, was an admin girl within the Air Force, and she's telling me this is what she says to me. I'm here because I can relate to what you've gone through. I leaned back in the chair, took a deep breath, and just let it go. I mean, how do you come back with, you what? You know, I was a 30-year infantryman. How can you, a female Air Force tech sergeant, 20 years, an S1 kind of person, how can you stand there behind me and tell me that you're equal with me? You know what I've been through.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? It's crazy.
Don't say that.
You need to be locked up.
But Mike, now what's the problem with that? And again, I want to go back to Mike's point. Mike has what, 30 years in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, 30 years.
30 years in the Marine Corps. I got out, but I joined in 83, and so I've been around it. We know what we rate. We know what it takes for these kind of things, because we've been around it for a long time, and you hear these arguments, and then you start paying attention to them when they talk about VA ratings or this and that and that thing. If you're in for 3 or 4 years and you get out, you don't know that stuff, and you walk in, and they say they're going to help you, and the Mike's anger that he's talking about, what happens with younger guys is they just say, F it, I'm out. I'm not coming back to this bullshit. And that's exactly what we don't need, Pat. That's exactly the wrong answer.
Right. No, you're right.
And so that's why it's important to have combat veterans in those things to the extent you can. And I think the VA ought to make a huge push to get combat veterans to become therapists so that they can look at guys and say, yeah, man, we'll get you to a better place. I know, I mean, I was with yada, 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 and I've been there, you know, and my, it's not the requirement that you have to, you know, but you have to have some of the experience to be able to, you know, to talk to these guys with credibility.
Right.
Because their lives are at stake.
You're right. Yep. And they're going to open up to you because they trust you. They in their mind know that you've been through it. You've seen it too. You know what they're feeling and what they're going.
Mike, so let's talk about my guest, Mike Musselman here, joining me. He's the one that actually set up the Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman interview. So did you follow Ben Jeremiah through kind of his career? So he leaves Parris Island, he goes up to Wounded Warrior Battalion on the East Coast. He's working at the museum. First, and then for Sergeant Major Kent, did you stay in touch with him throughout?
Yeah, you know, So Kent was one of those rare breed of guys that, you know, that really truly cared about the Marines. And Kent was he was as good as they came. I mean, I truly adore that guy. I think the world of him. I learned a lot from him. And you know, I don't say that about every Star Major.
No, let me tell you, if you want to hear somebody who's not afraid to be critical of senior enlisted Marines, he's on right now. Okay. he is not afraid to let it rip.
Yeah, Kent is as good as they come. And, you know, Kent did a lot of stuff for me. And Jeremiah was already on a different path, and I had talked to Kent about pulling him over to work with me in the Marine Corps 3-gun shooting team. And he had already, saw me to Kent had already done, already had a plan for a workman. So, but, you know, he did that with him. But, you know, like I said, there were certain key guys in workman's career that really stepped in and helped him out at the right time. You know, and you kind of look back at that, you wonder what would have happened if something was just, if they would have wrote him off. You know, if drill sergeant got relieved, big deal, move on.
So. Well, you know, good question. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, probably that Navy Cross probably saved his life because it raised his level of visibility. And because that award is so uncommon, when he arrived, people kind of took notice. And the other thing they know is, hey, I don't need a guy with this kind of notoriety going sideways here. And so, took an interest in him, whereas if he was just another sergeant, you know, that's with those issues, probably not the same level of interest.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I was always attracted to take. So, you know, I pulled a guy in. One day we'll get him on the show. He's a great guy too. He's got a good storyteller. His name is James Gill, and James Gill was an individual who lost lower leg. And his eye and some of his movement, an IED blast, and kind of put away in the hospital. And same kind of it, you know, mindset that Jeremiah wanted to do. He wanted to get back to do Marine stuff, and they didn't want him around. They wanted to keep him in the hospital. And I convinced them to have him come work for me. So they gave him orders out of down here in San Antonio, Texas. He checked into Quantico, and he became one of our top shooting guys on the team. And continued to shoot very professionally on the three-gun guy, and he's an outstanding Marine. You know, the story goes on and on. You know, another guy, Sergeant Michael Wisnia, you know, he was thrown away.
Just lost him. We're going to take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. Hopefully Mike gets his cell phone back and gives us a call. So we'll continue. Here on a Wednesday edition, we're talking care, we're talking the aftermath of Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman's story, which is an incredible one. If you're just joining us and you didn't get to hear it live, it'll be up on the website here in a little bit, and then it'll be a YouTube video here later on today after we get them producing that. Oh, hold on. I believe this is him. You back?
Yeah, I'm back.
All right, keep going.
Unreliable home cell coverage here in Oklahoma.
There you go, Oklahoma.
Yeah, okay.
Keep going, Mike. You were talking about...
No, but, well, yeah, so, you know, and then there was, I mean, there's many, many guys in my career. Sergeant Michael Wisnia, they brought him over from 5th Marine to work with me at 1st Marine Regiment in my NTU section. Great guy. Everybody told me, Dave Furness is actually the one that called me up and said, hey, try and do something with this guy. And so I brought him over, got him orders, and working under... Well, just knowing what they've gone through and how to work with them and giving them time to heal, he became one of my top sergeants. And he eventually gets out, and now he's in the Paralympics down there in Brazil. He was part of the team going to the tryouts. And great guy. You know, again, has that will to live, want to do something, wanted to be treated like a Marine. And that's what a lot of them look for. They just want to come back and be a Marine again.
But that's so hard because it's not available for everybody. And then, you go through, you know, and you know, the other thing that I hear on a consistent basis is, you know, when you're on active duty, there's just all this support around you. You're with your, you know, you're with guys, you know, you're with Marines, and there's people watching out for you. You got to go to medical. You got to get here. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? You know, and when something's wrong, somebody's there. When you get off active duty, there's none of that. You're alone.
And I think that's the culprit of a lot of these suicides that we're, you know, you hear about on a daily basis, is those young guys that are there on active duty. They got somebody somebody's there that they can turn to, or someone that's watching them that knows they're going through something and assist them. When they get out, they get to these areas, and there's nobody there. There's nobody to step in and intervene, or they belong to organizations, you know, where it's not manly, you know, these, some of these motorcycle, you know, clubs that I've seen with, some of the guys that actually were pretty close to me that took their lives. It's not manly to go and tell, you know, Rufus that you've got a problem and you need to talk to somebody. He hands you a bottle of Jack Daniels and there's a cure for you. Yeah. You know, so it's really difficult for these guys. They need something, they need an avenue, and, you know, a lot of times people aren't going to pick up the phone, and call somebody. You know, it's just, we got to think of a different way to do this and take care of these guys.
Well, again, I think the biggest thing is peer-to-peer, and you've got to stay in touch. And, you know, and talking to every one of the guys I've spoken to this week, three incredible stories, Lance Corporal Brian Nagel, Navy Commendation with the VA, saves three guys by recognizing a tandem suicide VBIED in Ramadi and kills the driver of the container truck that knocks down a city block.
Right.
Right. You know, so Nagel goes to North Dakota and he struggles, and but he stays with it and he finally gets what he needs, and you know, and now he's married with kids and working as a sheriff. You know, Charlie Linville, he winds up at the top of Mount Everest, married with kids. Cool part of the interview is when he said he got his prosthetic leg and he'd put on weight. He's sitting on the couch and his daughter looks at him and says, does that mean we can go to the park now? Right.
Yeah.
And he looked at her and he said, yeah. And he said, and getting off the couch was the single most important thing I did. After I got off the couch, I became the guy that I was. But it was that first step, because I had walled myself off. I was depressed. My life was changing. There was uncertainty. I was medicated. You know, I was still wounded, and
yeah.
I was struggling. And he said, and then I plugged back in with some of my friends, my Marine friends, and then I became Staff Sergeant Linville again. And then you hear the same thing with Jeremy Workman. Although, you know, because of his visibility, he stayed in the Marine Corps, but just the pain of, you know, Navy Crosswinder working at the National Museum of the Marine Corps, everybody knows, they're all calling me a hero, and I'm a failure in my own mind, and this Navy Cross is killing me.
Right.
And so that's what you deal with, and so the ability to stay connected, and the ability to improvise, adapt, and overcome the failures of the VA. But there is no other route. You got to do that, and you can't quit. And that's Workman's message. Don't quit on it. Don't quit on
it.
And so
I
don't know. To me, that ought to be more of the message in the TAP classes that we go to. Like, yeah, we can tell you about all your benefits and all that stuff, and we should. But let me give you the coordinating instructions. Okay, it's not going to work well for most of you guys. You're gonna have to fight for it. And you're going to have to, you know, work a number of these different agencies to get what you deserve. And you got to be committed to that.
That's a whole new conversation, that they need to revamp those TAP classes. I mean, that's a joke where we make these young guys come in business suits or collared shirts and ties, and we meet them, go do resumes, and, you know, it's just, come on, guys. We got their time a week or 10 days or whatever it is now. Let's best utilize it and really prepare these guys for what they're going to be exposed to. Let's call it as it is. Don't candy coat this thing and tell everybody that, you know, everybody, once you walk out of here, here's the book, because everybody's going to help you. Well, the problem is, yeah, but trying to get a hold of anybody in that book, and then trying to make an appointment with somebody in that book, and then explaining your story 5 or 6 times to the people while you show up that interview. And, you know, it's just, the process is flawed, broken. And, you know, I always say, I said back then, they got to have some kind of bean counters that kind of look at the numbers and say, you know, if 25% of these guys are getting so frustrated in the way they're treated, yeah, they're not going to come back. So we're only dealing with this percentage, you know, this is what we're going to deal with. And they keep that business model up. Cause and there's going to be people that are going to say, no, you're absolutely wrong, Gunner, this is.
That's what I want to say. You know, I want to say you're absolutely wrong. There's no way they could be doing that.
But you got to prove to me otherwise. It just makes no other sense.
No, and I'll tell you what. And when you hear the head of the VA say the amount of time they wait isn't important, does Disneyland count the amount of time you wait at Disneyland?
Yes.
No.
When he's returned to the Disneyland rides wait lines to the VA, you're being led by clowns. And there's an asshat. That guy, just give that guy the asshat award of the year. I mean, come on.
No. No. And so I think instead of, you know, bring me a resume, hey, show me your unit's Facebook page on your cell phone. I want to know that you're plugged into that. Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me that you got it. All right. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
All right. And then we're going to bring different Marines in here and they're going to talk to you about their frustration with the VA, and we're going to get real this afternoon. And when you walk out of here, you're going to have a little card that says improvise and adapt and overcome, but do not quit. Because you know what? We know that, Mike, right? Improvise, adapt, overcome. That's how we do it.
Right.
We live it. So if that's my mindset, when it begins to happen to me, instead of getting so frustrated, you know, I might think, hey, you know, they told me this was going to happen. And so I'm going to go plug into the VSO, the Veteran Service Officer.
Right.
I'm going to find another way to do this thing, to lick this ice cream cone. And I'm going to get it done. Because they prepared me mentally for that, but I never sat through a lecture like that in the 3.5 days of TAP that I went to on 2 different occasions. Never sat through.
Well, again, if they're serious about it, you know, hey, have the government award these law firms. You know how many damn lawyers we got in the United States, but award law firms to take up these pro bono cases for these young VAs to take their case in front of the VA. You know, give them some type of incentive to do these things, either in a very low cost or pro bono.
And let me tell you,
we're not talking about a million guys. You know, we're talking about, in a lot of cases, once they start doing that, they're going to get the treatment that they deserve.
No, and if you're, I'll tell you what, just as Mike said that, if you're looking for a pro bono law firm, go to www.allmarineradio.com, click on the show notes page, and you'll see 2 documents that say John Dowd's list of law schools, and I think John Dowd's list of something else. You click on those, and it will give you law firms and law schools that do pro bono work for veterans. Okay, and if you're not, if you think you need to, you know, you've been told, well, we've done as much as we can do. You'll have to get a lawyer, but you don't have the money for a lawyer. These people will represent you, and do not hesitate to contact them because they lean into this stuff.
And those guys are the true heroes for what they're doing. I mean, they're not getting paid for it. They're doing it just out of because they know. That these young people deserve more.
Well, you know what? I don't know if you heard the interview with John Dowd. He said it's the most popular legal work among young attorneys at these firms because they sit there and they talk to, you know, these veterans and they hear the stories. And
right.
He said they're like all up in the VA at that point.
Right.
Like, wait a minute. This guy, like, I went to law school. This guy, he went to Fallujah, Ramadi, then he went to Helmand. Right? And now this is what he's going to get? Oh, hell no, that ain't happening. Not as long as I'm his attorney. And so he said it's the most popular legal work for young attorneys in those firms, and that it's spread across the country for that reason when it started in a small handful of law firms originally a few years ago.
All right, yeah.
All right. Mike, first of all, I appreciate you taking time out and talking to us, but and also absolutely want to thank you for putting together the best interview that I've ever done in over 10 years of radio. So thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
Okay, Mike. You have a good day, and I'll talk to you later.
All right. There you go. Mike Musselman, the Gunner, right here on All Marine Radio. More of a that coming up next here on a Wednesday, 10:49.
It's actually 11:19 right now, so that'll do it. That was the Gunner's reaction after we did the interview, but good stuff. That'll do it. An hour and 20 minutes over. Your bonus coverage here on your home for All Marine Radio. That's right. Jeremiah Workman, what do you say? And the thing you want to thank him for is, you know, talking about this is reliving it again. And that's not easy. So, first of all, to him, for doing it almost 2 years ago, thank you. And the detail that he'll discuss it, and his candor, awesome. He's a straight-up man. So, my thanks to Jeremiah Workman for doing that. And the other thing I want to mention is kind of the theme of the program today, which is there's all kinds of people out there that need help. And so I think it's important that we as veterans help them. And so the first thing you got to do is you got to help yourself so you can help other people. And whether they're veterans or not, it doesn't matter. A lot of people are affected by post-traumatic stress. And you could be an example of, to use Elizabeth Smart's words, you can be happy. You can live the life you wanted to live. It doesn't need to stop you. So, again, Elizabeth Smart. Great example. Abducted at the age of 14, raped on a nightly basis for almost 9 straight months. She's got every excuse in the world built in to be dysfunctional and to check out. But she's a mom now. She's married, and she's doing good things for other people, so I think she's a great example for all the rest of us. So, on a Wednesday, thanks for listening. This program repeats itself momentarily. We will see you tomorrow. Out.